This week, Lloyd Langford on snooping, Marcus Brigstock on loopholes, Laura Shaving on the phone to her agent,
and Mitch Benn is on fire. I'm Hugh Dennis.
I'm Steve Punt. Welcome to
The Noel Show!
And the Greek economic crisis staggered on this week as things became clearer after last Sunday's election. The pro-bailout New Democracy won 129 seats in the Greek parliament, although in fact everyone sits on the floor and all the seats are on eBay. Much depends on the country attracting tourists again, and sure enough, on Monday, Greek voters awoke to a sign of their economic future. The Germans had laid a massive towel over Athens. Greek finance ministers are placing all their hopes on a series of controversial new money-raising measures.
And welcome back here to Royal Ascot for the 3:15. There are 8 runners and a giant wooden horse on wheels.
The actual solution inevitably involves yet more bailouts.
Yeah, the Eurozone seems to have been built on a system whereby some sort of magical, benevolent, global organisation hands you what you ask for every year and you don't need to do anything. In fact, it's remarkable that the North Pole doesn't have a seat on the G20.
OK, next we need to turn to Greece's structural deficit.
Mr Claus, if you could just...
Let's have a look then, dear Santa. I would like 80 billion euros, the Elgin marbles and a link to Tullius's video, please.
Now, Father Christmas is a pretty accurate representation of Europe's financial system. People you look up to tell you to believe in it, but eventually you grow up and realise it was all based on a massive lie. And also, Europe's actual Santa Claus is getting kind of fed up with the job.
Ach, I told you before, I will not wear the beard.
And even after the election, Greece is still in deep trouble. You know things are bad when you turn on Homes Under the Hammer, and it's the Acropolis.
Europe, though, is doing sterling work as the current scapegoat for every leader in the world to blame their problems on, including the $1 trillion in debt, home of the subprime, the United States. Barack Obama told the G20 summit that the world was
very concerned
about the slowing of growth and that
now is the time to stabilize the world financial system.
Wow, nothing gets past him, does it? What's he after? An honorary degree from the University of the Bleeding Obvious? There are very few other jobs where you can get away with behaving as world leaders do.
Help! Help! Help!
Help, lifeguard! There's a woman drowning in the deep end of the pool!
Help!
A woman is drowning. We deplore this situation. And now is the time for some sort of plan to stop her sinking. Now, what do you think, David?
Somebody help me!
We need a roadmap for rescue!
I agree with my friend here. We need a plan. And the time for that plan is now. So let's schedule a meeting next month and decide what to do then.
After umpteen summits and meetings of that overstaffed boy band G20, no one will commit themselves to anything other than a roadmap. A roadmap in this day and age, not even a sat-nav. Programmed to find a route for Greece.
At the end of the loan, vote left. Then vote right. Then ask the Germans to drive.
And how annoying must it be to have David Cameron turning up from his no-growth, 2.5 million out-of-work country and telling the rest of Europe what they're doing wrong? Cameron is a bit like that Harry Enfield character who waits until everyone has exhaustively thrashed out a plan for the euro and then turns up going,
only me now. You don't want to do it like that, do you? You want to do it like this. Oh, hang on, where's my daughter?
What they did agree on, though, was that the new Greek coalition was a good thing. Everyone agreed about that.
Everyone, that is, except the newspapers, who really wanted them to go back to the drachma because they were really enjoying working out the headlines. If they'd crashed out of the euro...
Drachmageddon!
If Germany seemed to be bleeding them dry...
Drachula.
If the story goes on and on...
Draconori.
And, of course, should Silvio Berlusconi stand again in Italy...
The old lira is back. On top of all this, in one of those inevitable examples of something or other, the European Football Championships have managed to produce a head-to-head quarter-final clash between Germany and Greece.
Will you join us here for Germany versus Greece? The Germans in their traditional whites with black shorts and the Greeks playing in their pants. Thanks to the kid austerity measures imposed by their opponents. First up, the coin toss.
Germans have cold heads.
And the Greeks have nicked the coin. And Samaras is straight away in trouble with the referee. He's being shown a card.
It's his credit card. He's been cut in half right in front of his face, and that's got to hurt.
Well, we're in play again. Karagounis, Maniatis, Torosidis. You have to say, Jeff, the Greeks are digging deep here. They really are giving 100%.
Yes, and that is a pretty steep interest rate, but that is what the banks demand. And wait, it's over the deadline, and that's a penalty.
So it's Podolski who steps up. And he scores! 1-0 to Germany, plus interest, plus inflation. So 4-0 to Germany. England, of course, have also made the quarterfinals after victory against Ukraine at the confusingly named...
Donbass Arena.
Confusing, because in this era of corporately named stadiums like the Emirates and the Reebok, the Donbass doesn't sound like it should be in Ukraine at all. It sounds like a ground sponsored by a South Yorkshire fish magnate.
Good afternoon. Welcome to the Donbass Arena. Please welcome your chairman, John Bass.
Thank you. Thank you. Today sees the opening of the new Cod, Coley and Haddock stands. A major investment for the club to make sure that football is open to as wide a public as possible. Corporate membership is still available in the Monkfish and John Dory boxes. Thank you.
Now, our guest this week emailed his script off to the producer and got some notes back from Theresa May. To investigate further, please welcome Lloyd Langford.
Hello there. I'd like to talk to you today about the Draft Communications Bill, which, if passed, would allow the government increased access to information about our internet usage, phone calls and emails, without having to go to the trouble of contacting a former News of the World reporter. I don't know about you, but I'm not sure I want the cabinet following me about online. I don't want to be pipped at the post at an eBay auction by William Hague. If the bill gets passed, internet service providers and phone companies would store our communication data. If you visit a website, the domain name and IP address would be recorded, but the pages within the site would not be logged. This strikes me as immaterial. If the intelligence services know the website name, they can hazard a guess at what's on the pages. For example, if you're regularly visiting www.bouncymelons.com, it's probably fair to say you're not a scientist investigating fruit bruising in areas of tectonic friction. But the question remains, why? Enter Theresa May. That's a stage direction rather than a command. The Home Secretary has been championing the Draft Communications Bill with all sorts of spurious nonsense. It's useful to unpick her argument by focusing on some of her main points.
Ordinary people have nothing to fear.
But then C.S. Lewis said there's no such thing as an ordinary person, and then proved it by writing a book where Jesus was reimagined as a talking lion.
It will bring criminals, terrorists and paedophiles to justice.
But surely our intelligence needs to focus on evidence, leads and investigative police work, rather than a blanket assumption that everyone in the country needs to be more strictly monitored. You fight crime by narrowing down the suspects, not increasing them to around 62 million. That's why when Inspector Poirot calls all of the potential murderers together at the end of one of his investigations, he can do it in the drawing room of a stately home, rather than on a 20-mile square patch of land he's had to reclaim from the sea. It's why Commissioner Gordon only puts up the bat signal when he thinks a crime is in progress, rather than having on a perpetual bat signal and then letting Batman figure out the rest for himself.
I have no doubt the conspiracy theorists will come up with some ridiculous claims about how these measures are an infringement of freedom.
I don't understand how opponents of the Draft Communications Bill can be labelled as conspiracy theorists. The reason we feel paranoid is because you plan to watch all of us, all of the time. That's also why I feel it's a misnomer to call this bill a snooper's charter. The insanity of this bill becomes truly apparent when you realise that it can ask the Royal Mail to retain and make a record of all information written on the outside of all correspondence within the UK for up to 12 months. I mean, they have enough trouble posting the bloody letters. How do they face the task of archiving and cross-referencing all of the senders and addresses? And what's it matter what's on the outside of the letter anyway? Does a slightly skew-if stamp placement indicate a latent desire to topple the monarchy? I don't know much about Al-Qaeda, but I very much doubt they plan much of their operations via postcard. Wish you were here with a bulging rucksack. I think this is a bad idea. I'm not going to go as far as some people and liken this potential erosion of our civil liberties to the situation in China, though in the context of David Cameron's recent attempt to cull a child from his family unit, maybe comparisons are apt. I've been Lloyd Langford, and remember, for the time being anyway, those who don't delete their browsing history are doomed to repeat it. Thank you and good night.
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Mitch Benn.
So David Cameron this week angrily dismissed statements by Vince Cable, drawing comparisons between the current financial crisis and the Great Depression of the 1930s. This is not the 1930s. Oh, dear me, no. There's no racial strife in Europe like 80 years ago. They had problems, we do too, but ours are different. We're not plagued with division and weak leadership in Parliament. Oh, yes, you can draw parallels, but it's really not the same. There's no pariah nation winning hearts and minds with the Olympic Games. The poor and homeless don't have to watch the rich living like kings. And Germany isn't slowly taking over everything. This is not the 1930s. Oh, no, indeed. There are no press barons holding sway, exploiting fear and greed. No hardline right-wing nationalist winning elections, big or small. No rumblings of revolution anywhere at all. No rising unemployment. No shattered neighborhoods. No champagne-quaffing blue bloods telling us it's all for our own good. So we'll all keep calm and carry on and muddle through somehow. We're not headed for disaster. It's not the 1930s now.
For the first time in decades, doctors have gone on strike over pensions. Apparently pensions need to be reformed because people are living longer.
And whose fault is that, eh? Eh? Doctors? You shouldn't be complaining about the pensions crisis. You caused it. If it wasn't for doctors, we'd all still be snuffing it at 70 and there wouldn't be a pensions crisis. We could plough all that extra money into tax cuts. We wouldn't need care homes and geriatric wards. And Paul McCartney probably wouldn't be looking quite so cheerful. In fact, if doctors really want to do something for the economy, they should go on strike more often. Except, of course, they're not very good at some aspects of it.
Scab! 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 Scab!
Actually, it's dried exudate sanguinaceous crust.
For heaven's sake, if you're in an operating theatre removing a vital organ, remember never to use the phrase, one out, all out. The whole idea of doctors going on strike is quite sinister. Their chief tactic is to strike for a day and then go and see the health secretary and say,
tell me when it hurts.
And if he says, no, we can cope with a one-day strike, then they do it again and then say,
does it hurt now?
No, we're fine, we're in great health.
Now, don't be silly, I'm going to recommend a course of immigrant bashing and trumping up a row with Argentina. That usually does the trick. You'll be popular again in no time.
But you're on strike, Doctor.
Yes, but we don't want bloody Miliband in. He's suing us for operating on his adenoids and it making no difference to his annoying voice grommet.
And of course, it's not just doctors. Everyone seems to be threatening to strike for extra pay during the Olympics, on the grounds, usually, that they're going to be a bit busier at work.
Yeah, after the bus drivers, tube drivers and taxi drivers, Southwest Trains has attacked the RMT union for ordering a strike ballot after demands for an Olympic bonus were refused, after the union learnt that up to 80,000 extra visitors a day would be using Waterloo Station, causing a huge increase for staff.
What possible difference does it make to train drivers how full their trains are going to be?
Oh, this train is so full. I'm not sure I'm going to be able to push it along the track. No, hang on, it's the big engine at the front that does that, isn't it? Oh, but still, the stress!
Can I ask you what stress?
Well, yeah, I'm having to drive a train that's, like, packed with people, crammed into every available space with no chance for a seat, despite astronomic ticket prices.
Right, and what's the problem?
Well, if it's like that now, what's it going to be like during the Olympics?
Thank you very much.
And now we welcome back to the show, after an absence of many, many months, angry jazz hands at the ready, is musical theatre's own Marcus Brigstocke.
Hello
Hello. It's very lovely to be back here on the Now Show. They even sent a car to collect me. Jimmy Carr, as it happens. It's very quick getting me here. He knew a way of avoiding, well, paying any tax, as it turns out. Of course, I would have come by train, but because I didn't know I was going to grow up to be a comedian working on the radio when I was 5 years old and would need to come here today, I missed out on the advance off-peak saver rate. I was going to ask Jimmy Carr to help pay the fare for me, but he needed the money so that, well, so that no one else got any. He's one of the most skillful, hard-working, ambitious comedians this country has ever produced. He just happens not to care about anything. And unfortunately, he did some jokes on Channel 4 about Barclay's aggressive tax avoidance scheme, which means I have to do this now. Have to. He said, you'll need the world's biggest, most aggressive team of blood-hungry, amoral tax lawyers. If you meet the criteria, you'll pay 1% tax, like Barclays do. Which, you know, what he really meant to say was, like Barclays and I do. Typical Jimmy, you know, he never thinks of himself. I know all about the scheme he's got in the Channel Islands because I was offered it and said no. Yes, feeling rather smug. Turns out I don't earn enough. No, I was offered it because I'm posh, and we get offered stuff like that in the same way we get offered grouse and foie gras and the chance of marrying a slightly distant relative. You know, because posh people treat their money the same way they treat their children. Send it away, and when it comes back, it's bigger. If it still doesn't seem quite right, send it to Switzerland. Someone will look after it. Speaking of tax scams, here's the thing. You know how the railways used to belong to us? They did. The railways and the water companies and America, they all used to belong to us. And then they got privatised, and they've all turned to rubbish, and they don't work because they're run by horrible people. So when the railways were ours, before the government sold them off in 1994, we subsidised the railways with somewhere between £1 billion and £1.5 billion, as you'd expect. Now that they're no longer ours, instead of giving them £1.5 billion, like you'd expect, we give them £4 billion, like you wouldn't expect at all. I mean, as far as not meeting with expectations goes, I'd put that up there with buying a punnet of seasonally available soft fruit and finding Jeremy Hunt's resignation letter inside a strawberry. There it was all the time. It's the last time I go and do pick your own drunk. We subsidised the railways £4 billion of taxpayers' money, so, Jimmy, you can ignore this bit. £4 billion a year, 35% more than any other nation in Europe, despite massive growth in UK rail traffic of 57%. Rail customers pay 30% higher fares than any other nation in Europe to ride on a privately owned rail network sold for about 20% of its actual value, which is about 40% less efficient than any other nation in Europe, but doing 57% more business than it was when we undersold it 99% faster than we should have done. Now, if you add those percentages together, and I'm no mathematician, but if you add those together, we can say with some confidence that the railways are approximately 8,000 times crapper than they should be. And I think we conclude fairly solidly that we have been 100% right in the... by a bunch of totally inept...
replacement bus service.
So, what I propose is that we give our railways to Jersey, and then they loan them back to us, and we then ride on them for free, using the people who sold them in the first place as a sort of rich, buttery fuel. The government commissioned a report by Sir Roy McNulty. Now, the McNulty report recommends we lose 30% of off-peak rail services.
We regret to announce that the train you thought you wanted to take is now more efficient and therefore doesn't run anymore because it's more efficient. Thank you.
So, 30% of services stopped, or 100% of the service you need to take if that particular off-peak train happens to be the one that carries you to work or home to your family or to the places where trains go, like York or Hogwarts or just outside the station due to a signalling failure. The McNulty report also questioned the extent of the regional rail network. You see, that's the problem. People seem to be wanting and even expecting trains to take them to places, and that represents a massive inefficiency for the poor old rail operators.
We'd like to remind passengers to not want to go to so many places, please. It is making our job very difficult. Thank you.
You want to make more money on the railways? Here's a way. You fine the rail companies per word for every stupid overlong announcement they make. I do not need to know that Leeds is my next station stop. I know it's a station. We're stopping. Just say Leeds. Say it twice if you like. Leeds, Leeds. If you're on a train and you don't know that the thing with platforms, a signpost, some people and seven pasty outlets is a station, you're not qualified to use a train. God, these announcements are so utterly pointless for normal, functioning humans. For your comfort and safety, First Connect Capital Premier Executive Direct Network Capital Locomotive Express Railway Train Base System. Recommend that passengers in possession of a breather ticket continue to allow the circulation of blood and oxygen around the body. I do not need full details of the buffet, which isn't a buffet. That's not how buffets work. Buffets have paper plates and you help yourself to as many scotch eggs as the paper will support. You do not have a full range of sandwiches. A full range of sandwiches includes all the things in the world in some bread. Oh, my good man, I'd like a diamond sandwich from your full range of sandwiches, please. No, in fact, I think I'll have a rocket and melancholy sandwich. Both kinds of rocket, please. Peppery lettuce and Stevenson's. I'd like this train in a sandwich with me inside eating a sandwich and some crisps by Escher. Say you subsidise the railways. Just stop people talking. I don't wish to alight or detrain. I'll get off. If I want to detrain, I'll go back to university and try to forget the things I learned. Very simple. We charge the rail operator £100 for every useless, unnecessary word they use over the PA system, and hey presto, we'll have enough spare cash to send our money on a holiday with Jimmy Carr. Thank you.
And please welcome back Mitch Benn.
Now, as I'm sure you know, one of the reasons we're all meant to be so cock-a-hoop about the Olympics is because of all the cool stuff and sporting facilities that's going to be left over afterwards, which will all be immediately put to good and improving use and not left to stand and rot for 20 years while various councils and committees argue pointlessly about what to do with it, honest. There is one particular item I'm actually quite interested in. If nobody's got dibs on it yet, can I Bagsy the inflatable Stonehenge, please? We are the Bansy, 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 at the dawning of the sun, on our inflatable stone circle, having fancy pagan fun. We go bouncing with our robes on, until we all fall in a heap, waving our foam rubber torches, and sacrificing blow-up sheep. We are the Bansy, 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 when the summertime is here, then we let down our stone circle and fold it up for one more year. We are happy and delightful. We are harmless and we're good. Please don't think we're scary like in that movie with Edward Woodward. We are the Bansy, 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 Bansy
Now, because the English language contains so much slang and so many dialect phrases, a book is being compiled of these to help tourists when they come here for the Olympics. So we've asked our audience this week whether they would like to contribute to this book.
So what's the phrase? Sorry, love, it's more than my job's worth. What does it mean? I know the answer, but I can't be asked to tell you. It looks like it's going to be a lovely day. What does it mean? Probably won't rain today. It's about 50-50, really. Or maybe a little light rain, but nothing more. Well, possibly a bit of light hail. Size of a tennis ball. Okay, there's a slim chance of Armageddon. But the sun might come out. You know, a bit later.
Oi, did you spill my pint? What does it mean? This is a friendly greeting. Usually from one man to another, inviting the addressee to participate further in a game with beer by pouring a pint of it over his head. Marvellous.
You're having a giraffe? What does it mean? There are no tickets available. I am looking for fast women. Could you please direct me to the women's athletics? Hotel convenient for Stratford. What does it mean? Hotel next door to Anne Hathaway's cottage.
Phrase, come on, Tim. What does it mean? The flickering hopes and dreams of a nation are about to be extinguished by the cold shower of superior talent.
Please form an orderly queue. What does it mean? Please form an orderly queue.
So thank you very much for those. We'll be sending those forward and enhance this book to a great degree. Thank you very much for listening and goodbye.
Thank you. That was an Alco starring Steve Punt and Hugh Dennis with Mitch Benn, Marcus Brigstock, Laura Shavin and Lloyd Langford. It was written by the cast with additional material from Jane Lammercraft, Gareth Gwynn, Rodri Crooks, Jessica Costacue, Madeline Brettingham and Tom Neenan. It was developed with Bill Dare and the producer is Victoria Lloyd.